I think we'll begin. We're waiting for our discussant to show up. I would imagine she'll be here in time. But we want to begin on time because this paper will take up the majority of the hour. First of all, I've been asked to remind you that the admission to this session is by name tag or ticket only. You probably know that by now. The paper of this session, which is presented by Catherine Lindquist, is entitled Sexual Hegemony and Liberated Mormon Women, Seeing Ourselves in the Bambara African Mirror. Her presentation will take approximately 45 minutes, after which the paper will be discussed by Sharon Swanson, and there she is. We hope to have time for questions from the audience as well. Catherine Lindquist earned her undergraduate and master's degrees in English from the University of Utah, and at present is a PhD candidate in American Studies with emphasis on cultural criticism and American women's art and literature. Catherine teaches writing and literature classes at the University of Utah, and this coming year will be teaching intellectual traditions of the West in the Department of Liberal Studies. She is a native of Utah and the mother of four children. All right, Catherine?
It's really an honor having Marilyn Morinsky introduce me because it was Marilyn's book, Patriarchs and Politics, published about 12 years ago, that revolutionized my thinking. She doesn't like to think of herself as a revolutionary, but she was for me. Some of you wonder what hegemony means. It's simply dominance. And as the paper moves forward, it will explain itself, I'm sure, for you. It isn't difficult when looking at the common people of what we call third world countries, countries in early stages of industrial development, from the position of our middle class, educated, medically technical, and industrially sophisticated country, to see not merely difference, but opposition. We immediately see people who are impoverished, malnourished, illiterate, perhaps what we consider barbaric in their treatment of others. It isn't difficult to believe that if we could nourish their bodies, we might nurture their souls, teach them right thinking and acting. The apparent oppositions between them and us would decrease. We could all live as sisters and brothers, the family of man, on this planet. It was with the intent to encourage cultural interaction between disparate countries and provide physical relief for the people in Walesebugu Province, Mali, West Africa, that the Walesebugu Utah Alliance was formed in Salt Lake City, and that was only about 5 years ago. The Alliance's goals are to raise money to finance development projects such as well digging, fence building, and medical assistance to enable these agrarian villagers to stay on their land and improve their health and literacy while becoming increasingly psychologically and economically independent of outside help. Women in Walesebugu are the main laborers and consequently the primary source of health care change, but have been largely ignored by male-dominated development agencies. Therefore, the expedition of March 1989, in which I participated, was designed to allow 8 Utah women, all from Mormon backgrounds, and 7 of us unmarried and employed in professional work, to talk to Malian women. Anxious to involve the Malian women in project planning as well as production, we hope to be able to live with them briefly to observe their routines and to ask them to prioritize their needs, the better to help them. Actually, the closest we came to staying with them was sleeping and eating in our own compound within a village. Consequently, our knowledge of the Bambara people, the Walesebugu people, are of the Bambara culture. So I'm throwing out a lot of African distinctive names, but Bambara people live in Walesebugu region in Mali, West Africa. Our knowledge of the Bambara people could never surpass the superficial. Our presence among them, however, allowed us to see ourselves not only through their eyes, but against their images, as though we were centered in a room of mirrors where multiple images rebound, each perspective flattened, fragmented, and reversed by the mirror's natural characteristics. This paper reassembles the images I personally collected of both mirror and reflection, Bambara and Mormon women, images two-dimensional because of vision limited and overdetermined by a multitude of influences, including education, religion, and experience. The paper attempts to break the surface of both images, to examine values and motives, discernible differences and similarities beneath that eventually dissolve oppositions. The paper's process simulates ways we use mirrors, language, law, and other people to define personal identity. The paper finally reveals itself as simply another slivered and reassembled, fabricated, dismembered truth, a reflection from my own myopic feminist third eye. Our first sight of Wolesa-Bugu villages confirmed previous knowledge of the Bambara people and their living conditions. The women were straight-backed and beautiful, and like us, of multiple colors, but darker, pale bronze to velvety black to dull ash, some gaunt-faced and thin, others round-faced and sturdy, all thick-necked and strong-armed, muscles distinct beneath scant and often ragged, bright, motley cotton prints wrapped round. They were encircled by and balancing in arms or on backs, numerous wide-eyed children, and all worked against a backdrop of single-roomed mud and thatch huts on dry red dirt, roaming with bony oxen and goats. Other information about the Malians we had accumulated earlier, that they are mostly Muslim, a strongly patriarchal and thus conservative religion, and that they live under a benevolent dictatorship that passes for democracy. The villagers are polygynous, each husband taking up to four wives. 95% of the women are illiterate. Unrecorded numbers die daily of traumatic childbirth or perpetual bleeding, and the infant mortality rate is the highest in the world. We saw then a people and land opposite from our suburban life, engorged with neat brick and glass homes, sprinkling systems, multiple vehicles, hospitals, schools, t-ball games and dance lessons, contraceptives and eyeglasses. Major distinctions seem clear. They spoke colloquial Bambara and, if educated, French, their colonial language, as Mali had been colonized by the French and liberated as late as 1960. So they have been on their own only for the last 30 years. Of course, we spoke English. They were impoverished, we were wealthy. They polygamous, we monogamous. They politically oppressed, we free to vote for laws and people to represent us. They were Muslim, we Christian. Finally, obviously, they, the Bambara, were needy. We Mormons were need-fulfilling. We arrived at the first village, Sunsunkuru, and descended from the back of our pickup truck, ready to address those needs. Both groups exchanged ikakinis, which are greetings in Bambara, and shook hands. As our interpreter busied himself with the men, we touched the sun-baked flesh and calloused hands while we pretend worked, danced, joked, and spoke with the women. The old women laughed vigorously at our ineptness with their musical instruments, gently poked and patted us, teased us for mispronouncing their names while indicating that our names were too strange, but tried nonetheless to repeat them. The young women shyly smiled, some handing us their bare-bottomed babies to hold and admire. Each village greeted us ceremoniously. Men led us to seats of honor under a shady tree where they and the older boys sat, grouped age-ascending around us. Females and infants formed another circle or worked at household chores outside the gathering. First, the community leaders, the chief, the patriarch, the priest, each welcomed us with speeches and gifts of live black and white speckled chickens subdued from hanging upside down. They always gave living gifts. Then our leader, the chairman of the board of the Wolesa-Bugu Alliance, and our male escort on the expedition accepted the gifts and replied, quote, "We are happy and grateful to be here with you. We come from a country and a city where there is a lot of money. But there isn't the happiness and the caring for each other and the feeling of unity that we feel here, unquote. Although several of us women were uncomfortable and angry that our representative had implied so clearly that we were rich, uncaring, and unhappy, he expressed other ideas most of us were feeling, for we had begun to see the people of Walesebugu through what we felt was a more accurate light. The women particularly, as we watched them about their chores on property without boundaries, exhibited a visual camaraderie we could not see within the walls of our closed homes and a casualness we saw missing from offices in tents with concentration. They worked together. They jointly bathed howling babies in plastic buckets, painstakingly and intricately cornrowed each other's hair, and walked arm in arm to the wells or fields or far into the bush for firewood. They strolled three or four abreast down rutted roads, balancing 30 to 60 pound loads on their heads. Babies bound to their mother's waists with swathes of brilliant cloth and content with the milk-laden breast always at hand. And the women laughed and waved to people they passed. They pounded millet until fine three times daily in huge gourd bowls with heavy wooden pestles, tossing the pestle high to clap rhythmically like this before catching it midair, or gracefully trading it with the neighbors as both women pounded in tandem. We saw how simple and uncluttered life could be without carpools and balance books, without furniture to clean and computers to repair, certainly with nothing to buy nor the means with which to buy it. Garbage was invisible because every item, each cloth or chicken bone or empty can or broken rubber thong, was used and reused in new form until it disappeared. This was subsistence-level living, and it appealed to a purer, more basic core, free from the labor and drive of conspicuous consumption in each of us. On the other hand, we saw through Western eyes, this life did not offer much choice. Books, ballet, symphony, paper and pen, crayons, fancy foodstuffs, canvas and oil paint also did not exist. How sad for the painters and engineers and mathematicians among these women, I thought, who would never, lacking time and material, know and express their talents. Would they ever know of the varieties of people beyond their villages? Did they care to know? Concerned with feeding their children and preserving their culture, they largely ignored the outside. They accepted some goods and services offered, but otherwise kept themselves distinctly different. Only fragments of Western civilization intruded. The plastic buckets, an occasional bike, a Mickey Mouse t-shirt, traditional and European prints combined into one body wrap. In short time, we realized that life itself was for them a creative enterprise. They transformed their hair and bodies into works of art. They traded oral stories and sang both traditional and spontaneous songs, danced singly and in human chains at public gatherings, and chanted as they swept village grounds and cooked and washed and weeded, the older women accompanying the workers with rattling gourds and thumping drums. They enjoyed creative moments peculiar to their own culture and environment, and their expressive mediums were natural, less dependent than ours on supplies manufactured and purchased in the market. We Utahns thus noticed less opposition than simple difference in surface detail between the two cultures. Having broken a layer of representation, we discovered that our feelings were ambiguous. We were glad for self-indulgent opportunities we perceived the Bambara life could not provide. But our entry into the Walesebugu villages resembled what anthropologist James Clifford has identified as a retreat to the garden, a refuge in an Edenic sanctuary from civilization, a momentary satisfaction of nostalgic yearning for something gone, for a life simple and primitive, uncluttered by industrial effluvium, motors, and material possessiveness, but replete with communal affection, innocence, and benevolence. Here we could see, as our leader's wife, our associate on the expedition, said, quote, peace of mind, companionship, and a oneness with oneself, end quote. Women chanting and cleaning, preparing food in pastoral quiet, colorfully wrapped or unabashedly bare-breasted, Babes on backs are playing peacefully with older siblings, chickens squawking and donkeys braying. Life natural, classless, outside of time, surely the way God had intended. For we have been taught here in Western civilization, particularly in America, where the agrarian principle blazed the trail across the continent, opening the frontiers and domesticating the land. We have been taught here as Latter-day Saints, whose pioneer ancestors are revered for making the desert bloom like a rose, and who believe the faithful, those who have been baptized into the church and have kept the commandments of truth, will reunite at Armageddon in Zion's garden to form a perfect society. We have been taught that people close to nature's heart, tillers of the soil, performing the most useful and necessary of labors, are people most integrated, closest to their authentic selves, to their core, to God. Yearning to adopt some of that authenticity, in addition to substantiating memory, we Utahns collected evidence, photos, cassette tapes, blankets and carvings, material images and objects to substitute for the meaning of this recent Edenic past, dismembered even as we lived it. Metonyms of something bigger, frozen paradigms of gestures, feelings, and relationships too brief, of impressions made upon us, the evidence stands for the something we desire, the illusion of wholeness, portrayed by and transmitted through association with a less sophisticated and more pristine people. By photographing the Bamburu women at work and recording their music on tape, we convert them into permanent objects of our gaze and thoughts to be reviewed time and time again. The mementos, which radiate a facsimile of the aura possessed by the too fleeting, too perfect moment, become fetishes, as psychoanalyst Jacques Lacan explains. They substitute for that something impossible to recapture, that sense of wholeness, and thus provide narcissistic pleasure through identification. Visual icons, the photographs of Bambara and Mormon together, dancing, playing, laughing, watching, serve another idealistic purpose. Rather than emphasizing opposition, they capture the integrated image of mirror and reflection. They celebrate the idea of synthesis, the reconciliation of Western conceived dichotomies such as black and white, pagan and Christian, ignorant and learned, poor and wealthy, student and teacher, receiver and benefactor. The photos and memories visually seem to blur distinctions between the most common of Western symbols, dark and light. Dark, of course, connotes everything unenlightened and therefore evil, as opposed to things white and radiant, like Christ's flesh and robes and spirit, and therefore good. The idea of unification among all disparities feels good to people desiring to feel both worldwide human commonality and individual spiritual wholeness. However, as the pictures and recordings naturally gloss the heat, sweat, smell, and physical discomfort we Utahns experienced as we made them, so too life is not so ideal. Even the brilliant noonday sun cannot expose what lies concealed. When we pry wide a narrow slit in Malian nature's slightly blemished flesh, we reveal other less savory aspects. Parasites and worms dwell in human stomachs to devour food. Malaria, cholera, and yellow fever attack indiscriminately and meet little resistance. Domestic animals such as oxen, chicken, goats, and sheep contaminate water with feces and trample or eat vegetables tenuously cultivated for children's nutrition. Rain falls too infrequently and too harshly when it comes. Dust suffocates, clogs nostrils and lungs, permeates clothing and interiors, and heat bakes the earth too hard for tilling or for drawing water. Likewise, when we look beyond the mirror surface, the Bambara surface of genuine human kindness, graciousness, beauty, and intelligence, we find other constituents. looming behind the sight of gentle fecundity, numerous children hand-holding, arm-entwining, baby-balancing is the reality of child mortality. 2 deaths out of 5 before the age of 5. These are due largely to birth complications, common diseases like measles and dehydration caused by diarrhea. Because infection runs rampant and mothers harvesting grain, carrying water, chopping wood with a new infant suckling have neither the time, energy, nor means to rehydrate a sick toddler as frequently as required. When one looks behind well-mannered, obedient children and hard-working, cheerfully working, obedient women, one finds child beating and wife beating. And if we dare expose ourselves as even more outrageous voyeurs and look beneath beautiful harlequin boo-boos, their native dress, and skirts on adoring mothers, we see mutilated, infected organs. It is customary, we learned, among the Bambara of Mali, as well as some other African and Middle Eastern cultures, to circumcise infant girls or young children of both sexes at least by the age of 15 years. Not for religious reasons, but for the avowed purpose of marking their culture. Boys are circumcised by removing the penile foreskin. Girls are circumcised by cutting off the clitoris at the very least, and usually, in the villages, by removing the vulva, all the external genitalia. Male circumcision, while painful, reduces neither the ability to reproduce safely nor to experience pleasure in sexual activity. Radical female excision eliminates both. Coupled with the Bambara compulsion to produce innumerable children, it subjects the anesthetized girls to infection and excessive bleeding following surgery. Later, it offers them genital tearing during childbirth and inhibited delivery that results in death for either the infant or mother. And frequently, it provides the woman constant hemorrhaging for a lifetime, inevitably ending in their painful and early death. The Western feminist idea of liberating the clitoris acquires new meaning through this act. For us, the clitoris connotes the ability to receive sexual pleasure, either from another or from the self. It emblematizes a general female desire, a desire not so much for sexual pleasure as for psychic freedom. This is the freedom to become the subject of our own discourse, to speak and act and think for the self, and to fulfill the self's desire for creative, sexual, intellectual, and spiritual expression, rather than to be solely a helpmate, a secondary position. First the object of the male gaze, and thus the object of his desire, and then the support for his psychic and sexual fulfillment. We women know the boundaries of such freedom. We know that, like men, we are not subjects free to make unlimited choices, but are instead overdetermined by internal and external, physiological and social historical factors that reduce freedom to a margin no broader than a thread. But the human impulse, the ego's drive, is to assert subjectivity nonetheless. To deny it is to be psychotic, to live forever in an imaginary realm where we are kept, non-functioning, little more than fetishes like our photos of the Bambara women, possessions to be collected and exhibited, used and ignored, or tucked away and forgotten. We Western women know, too, that no one can liberate the clitoris for another. To assert herself as an agent, a woman must freely acknowledge whether or not she possesses a clitoris that she desires and that she must stimulate consciously and actively whatever might satisfy that desire, rather than to depend on another. I have been speaking of the clitoris metaphorically as much as literally. Obviously, even though the Malian woman's desire for sexual pleasure may be removed before she is old enough to recognize that it exists, she feels other desires and experiences other pleasures. She enjoys her own realm of pleasure. her own realm of power. However, it is generally the case that her economic and intellectual freedom are as controlled as her sexual activity. She learns early that her body has many uses, primarily in a practical realm where book learning and speculation are superfluous, even impossible for her, she believes. From the age of 5, when she begins carrying pans on her head to strengthen neck muscles, her body serves her father. From this time on, she is responsible with her mother for creating the means to feed and clean the family. As she approaches the age of 15, her parents select her husband, and her body earns her father a groom's dowry, its amount determined by her virginity and her vaginal region's cleanliness, its freedom from excess flesh. A thorough excision will guarantee pain during intercourse and thus reassure the groom that his property, his wife, and her offspring will remain in his possession. The honeymoon reinforces the girl's knowledge of her body's duties: to satisfy her husband's sexual yearnings, to exhibit his virility, and to reproduce both the parents' labor pool and their chance for immortality. As the more offspring that survive, the more likely the parents will be remembered through the generations. To stimulate procreation immediately, the bride is given an herbal medicine 2 days before the marriage ceremony that makes her clean and docile. During the honeymoon week, bride and groom, accompanied by their female teacher, stay in a hut where others provide them food, particularly hot cereal for the bride to make her athletic and sour milk for the groom to increase his potency. The girl would generally have a child within the year and another each year or two until death or menopause. Her body will likely deteriorate quickly due to malnutrition, disease, exhaustion, the stress of multiple births, and continuous bleeding resulting in severe anemia. The Bambara female, then, knows early, probably unconsciously, that her body is a tool to raise capital and to provide labor, status, immortality, and pleasure for herself, yes, but more especially for others, for father, brothers, husband, and sons. We Mormon women could also examine ways our bodies become material means for increasing a male's power, beginning with the ritual of the father's bestowing a name and a blessing on his infant daughter, and delivering the bride later to her new husband. Or a priesthood leader's warning to adolescent girls that honorable young men do not want to buy and eat the donut with the frosting licked off. We could examine how men's bodies are used to serve others as well. We could discuss the filth beneath the Mormon surface, much of it inherent in a strongly patriarchal society. The incest, wife beating, rape, lower wages for women, the scarcity of women in management positions, white-collar crime and coercions by general authorities to hide or neglect an incriminating fact. But I am more interested in exploring examples of Mormon women, particularly those of us who consider ourselves liberated from overt male control, who recognize an attempt to satisfy their desire to assert autonomy and then unconsciously excise the means, thereby thwarting their own purposes. We women here do not need to look to know that we have a clitoris, but knowledge of its existence is surely comforting. Its presence signifies a body not sexually mutilated in a particular way. It represents possibility. Likewise, we women on the expedition knew immediately that we were different from the Bambara women in respects other than outwardly physical and cultural. We saw ourselves in Africa as possessing the freedom to travel beyond our immediate environment. Except for our chairman's wife, who was with us to accompany her husband, each of us saw that she was able to be there because she had economic means derived from an education and the ability to use skills to earn and keep an income. How we saw ourselves suggests that we are free from the sexual hegemonic relationship that marks the Bambara women, both psychically and physically. But of course, while many Mormon women enjoy these liberties, our group was not a cross-section. Except for the chairman's wife, we were all single and over 30. Had we been married, most of us would not have been on that expedition. And while we may consider that LDS men and women are becoming increasingly willing to admit that Mormon sociological and gender patterns for both sexes may be psychically suffocating and ultimately destructive, we must also admit that sexual hegemony exists no less in the Mormon culture than in the Bambara. Regardless of secular leadership possibilities open to women, men in the LDS Church feel more compelled now than in early church history to control church structure, capital, ritual, and administration. And LDS women feel compelled, no matter how liberated they may regard themselves, to allow men that privilege. Noted that women cooperate in their own subjection by trying hard to live down to what is expected of them. The Italian Marxist philosopher Antonio Gramsci reminds us that hegemony works from both directions. A group dominates only with permission from subgroups. Subordinate groups, be they racial, ethnic, religious, economic, or gendered, may resist suppression with language and action, but until they actually revolt and risk becoming tyrannical themselves, they primarily acquiesce to or support the ruling order. For us, that it is a white, Anglo-Saxon, middle-class, male-dominated, capitalistic order within which we have grown up and which therefore appears perfectly natural, thus God created rather than man-made. Though we know God did not come down here and provide us with language, the basis for law and interpretation and symbols and hence meaning. All these elements are not fixed ideals, but are dynamic like us, constantly changing and expanding according to knowledge and cultural needs. And the people who control them obviously control the culture. While we Mormon women might condemn Bambara women for permitting their daughters' sexual mutilation to continue, we too are both subjects and products of our own language and culture. We too must negotiate for personal identity within its bounds. And we contributed actively to male domination on the Walesibuku expedition, as do our sisters at home, no less than the Bambara midwives who performed the sexual excisions in dirt huts with dull knives for economic as well as traditional and social reasons. For instance, the Mormon wife in Mali played sentinel for her husband, our silently acknowledged expedition leader, when he was not available to corral the newly observed order-threatening feminism some of us exhibited. "Don't you think we're being divisive, only talking to the women," she said to us after we insisted on holding the discussions focused on women against his apparent wishes. "Shouldn't we give the men equal time?" she said. She formed her objections as questions rather than assertions, acknowledging the fragility of her position while remaining dutiful to her womanly role. The guardian mentality becomes a surrogate superego, reminding offenders of cultural obligations, its shoulds and should nots. It also reports to the patriarch when his greater presence is required to keep ideas in line. "Do I need to be here?" he quietly asked her when he briefly visited one of the Mormon Bambara women's meetings. "No," she whispered back. "They're the same questions as last night." Safe questions, she meant. Not related to male supremacy and female slavery, as he expected from radical feminists, and therefore non-inflammatory. Another woman on the expedition demonstrates her social autonomy by establishing a home, albeit all female, down to the chickens, and directing a major business department, a task requiring strong administrative and arbitration skills. She has chosen to devote her life to teaching young people to become professionals, to working for environmental safety, and to leading women's organizations in the church. She might even chuckle at the notion of subjecting herself to marriage. But on the expedition, she protected the priesthood's right to lead by jokingly obeying, not protesting, when its decisions contradicted the journey's original goal of a female exchange. She inadvertently protects the Bambara tradition of performing female sexual excisions by avoiding the issue altogether. She insists that we not interfere, however subtly, through Bambara cultural channels by supplying health information or specific medical assistance, because to do so would be cultural intrusion, as though our presence were not an intrusion already. However deplorable she finds the practice, do her motives differ substantially from the Bambara mothers who accept brutality upon their daughters because they consent to life the way it has been, a tradition for centuries? Or because, more pragmatically, they recognize that disobedience would socially punish their daughters by forever excluding them from the marriage market and thrusting them into ostracism or lifelong parental dependence? A young expedition member is a doctor in secular life. She used her medical knowledge and skills decisively and expediently in Mali when she administered care to a taxi driver who had inhaled too much dust through the cab's windows and was suffocating to death. She saved the man's life. Yet when we women returned to Utah and had waited with some complaint for over 4 months to be invited to join the Alliance Board of Directors, as we had been promised, she advised that we be patient, not too pushy. At that time, the Alliance Board, a community organization, was 90% male and 95% LDS. We Utah women, wanted to gain for ourselves what we desired for the Bambara women: representation in development planning as well as production. We wanted to do more than the physical labor. Perhaps the doctor thought the men on the board were also waiting for approval from some higher source. Do her reasons for tolerating men's neglect and rudeness and promoting women's passivity, moves contradicting her professional behavior, differ from the Bambara woman's, who has submitted to playing a silent and obedient role in organized village politics, a role outside the inner circle, that she accepts because it is what she has been taught and what she knows her leaders, all male, expect of her, even though she is justifiably angry? Two other expedition women hold professional positions by right of education and experience in powerful LDS church institutions. One has also fought to retain her briefly held assignment as first female in a traditionally male-occupied church position. She nonetheless reported to the Alliance Board of Directors on the information gained from the expedition women's talks and omitted any mention of female clitoridectomies and associated physical problems, though women's health has direct bearing on their ability to perform labor and thus carry out development goals. This is a project concerned with the whole Walesa Buku population, for goodness sake, not just women. And besides, some information might offend delicate ears. Incidentally, the board agenda scheduled the women's report, supposedly the most important item from the expedition, for the end of a long meeting. As expected, many members had left before it could be delivered. The other woman who works in an LDS-directed business has battled with male overseers to cover and report women's issues through a local newspaper. In order to transmit important public information, she has resisted intimidation from political figures to stay silent on volatile issues. But she succumbs to pressure from editors to censor her own work if she wants it printed. She knows which point of view must be ignored and which prioritized. If she feels she can squeeze in an abrasive fact or provocative perspective that might challenge LDS values, she knows she must bury it toward the story's end. Might the motives of these two women resemble the fear of even educated Bambara women, mothers, who fail to intervene in their daughters' behalf because they themselves are threatened with beatings or loss of financial security? Still another woman, I, overly cautious, lacking recognized authority, and respectful of propriety, allowed herself to be ordered by the expedition leader not to participate in a short information-gathering excursion that would have inconvenienced no one. She meekly descended from the truck and returned to her proper place, though the leader offered no viable reason for his command. This kind of woman does not protest loudly or vehemently enough about injustice until she feels secure about the appropriateness or validity of her remarks. Often she is too late to make a difference. These women I have described, including the Bambara, have power. We all have found the means to exert an individuality, a small degree of autonomy, an important measure of subjectivity. We have power to heal, to create, to nurture, to perpetuate and change cultural mores and tradition through stories, to barter in the marketplace, to feed the world, to politic on both formal and informal levels, and to manipulate others, even men, for selfish or altruistic reasons. Yet we all generally behave as though motivated by fear, fear of punishment, job loss, or beatings, or embarrassment, fear of hurting our children, fear of drastic change, fear of not gaining eternal salvation, fear of ostracism, fear of not pleasing others, or fear of being marked different and therefore evil. Behind all these fears lies another, fear of knowledge. And as Julie Nichols pointed out yesterday, especially fear of knowledge, because if you know something, you have to act on it. If we give or take the wrong information, we face the aforementioned penalties. If we would survive in our culture, we must constantly hide or refrain from listening to information that would make people squirm. We must stay silent or relegate facts to back pages and ends of meetings. We must constantly question any authority but that which our culture, the Mormon or Bambara, has deemed the highest on earth. Even God or nature, whoever gave woman a clitoris and invited her to desire, plays absent composer to the patriarchal conductor. Bambara and Mormon alike contribute to societies that have created, according to Kenneth Burke, a conspiracy of piety, a conspiracy about what properly goes with what. We are devoted to honoring practices like sexual excisions or figuratively partaking of the blood and flesh of Christ, practices that we transform into rituals and then sustain in the name of religion or tradition because they demonstrate our loyalty. The word piety, Burke says, contributes to the desire to round things out, to fit experiences into a unified whole. Our culture conspires with women's contribution against the yearnings of the self and builds a network of systems to make sense of a chaotic world. This kind of unification requires a plan like the one for eternal salvation, a network composed of taboos and expiations, definitions of proper behavior, and thinking to keep people straight. It requires a bureaucracy headed by a logic-directed patrilineal order like the Mormon or Muslim priesthood organizations who themselves fear the exuberance, the unruly desire, even the climactic moment of women. All this looking behind must bring us back to the mirror's face. Through scrutiny, the self does not disappear into the mirror, but becomes more visible as qualities magnified. We see then that it is only the degree of inequality or characteristic, hair texture, eye and skin color, clothing use, body condition, intelligence, goodness, need, psychic or spiritual freedom that determines difference among people. We know that world cultures represented by Bambara and Mormon are not opposite. We blend, like the speckled chicken gifts the villagers gave us, black and white together and perhaps a bit insensible from having hung upside down too long. And knowing really how similar we are, we exaggerate difference in order to stand apart, to justify hierarchies, to create a special identity. People must be the Diné, as the Navajo call themselves, the people. Each must be like the Jews, the chosen. Each must follow, like the Muslims, the prophet of the one true God. Each must inherit, like us, the church of the sign of the greatest good, for us, Jesus Christ. That is why most Bambara women openly support the sexual excisions. They see them as a sign of a true woman, a Bambara woman courageously facing pain and physically distinct in a secretive personal way from a white Western woman. That is why Mormons wear underwear with their own secret markings, and why most Mormon women, even the liberated ones, actively support their own subjugation. We all desire to assert an agency, a subjectivity that declares we not only exist but are essential to life and truth. But a collective subjectivity increases our power. If we would be more than merely reflective about the image in the mirror, if we would be reflexive, probe beneath and act upon our knowledge, we must still ask, who are we? Who am I? And in our need to negotiate identity with the people around us, we confront the three possibilities that Gramsci defined: acquiescence, support, and rebellion. Sometimes we must compromise the self's desires for the sake of the self and our children, for the sake of living peacefully in the community. Often we have enough faith in the principles behind the system that we stay and work. We speak out, like most of the speakers at this conference, to create space for greater agency within it. Sometimes, for our mental health, we must leave the system altogether. Whatever our decision, we recognize that we need others, our own kind and opposites, to confirm our identity, to confirm what we see is our value by comparison. Thank you.
Thank you, Catherine, for a most provocative, thoughtful paper. This paper will be discussed now by Sharon Swenson. Sharon also received her BA and MA degrees in English from the University of Utah and is also working on a PhD. She was recently released from a three-year stint as Relief Society president and now serves as a visiting teacher in the church. She and Paul Swenson are the parents of a son and a daughter. Sharon? Let me say now, in case we lose part of the audience, because we're running a little over time, I was asked to announce that the banquet tickets are available after this session, but will not be available after that.
My question, after the question of how can you say hegemony, I've been practicing for a week and find myself really incapable of pronouncing it accurately on every occasion. Hegemony or diversity, and do we have to choose? Lindquist's paper strikes at the heart of several key issues. One might say it's a seminal paper, were it not so inappropriate for the mood the paper has established. What difference does difference make in the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints? This includes differences of gender, class, age, nationality, education, and personality. Secondly, how much difference can a community of Mormon believers accommodate? Third, what can or should a Mormon woman, particularly a Mormon feminist, do regarding issues of action, complicity, guilt, fear, exploring the relative merits of trying to change the system from within, of choosing to make or not make waves that disturb family or employment or self? Lindquist's essay is skillfully constructed using a specific, concrete, first-hand experience. She involves the reader or the listener in a romantic fantasy about noble savages and Edenic harmony with the earth, and then shocks us by revealing the pain, the ugliness beneath this surface. The blend of personal, political, and psychological material is very forceful. She discusses the power of the metonymic images, of the photographs and mementos she and other women collect of this experience in Mali, creating an identification we all feel with our own efforts to separate, to capture souvenirs, an experience and identification that becomes a knife in our hearts as we realize first These images reify and fetishize the experience of these women, and we have become metonymic, fetishistic, reified ourselves. We have become images that lack substance to viewers and users, and even to us, to those they directly represent. The use of her mirror imagery is particularly effective, especially the idea of the mirror, which all of us, or many of us, recognize from our experiences in the temple ceiling rooms, where the first time I had the experience of having mirrors face each other and was when the man who married us said, "Look, you go on and on into eternity," as my husband and I looked at each other, and we did, and we have now for 22 years. But that notion that we see in many ways as uniquely eternal, of gazing into another and seeing another, her plays upon the idea of subject and object and the relationship of these concepts to a cultural concept become very involving and convincing. But the shock treatment, the repeated shock treatment she gives us as she makes the leap from the experience in Africa to the experience we know well, makes us squirm. And the feeling of discussing the liberating power of the clitoris demands an emotional reaction. There are several points of the paper and her method with which I could quibble. For example, the equivalence of the penis or clitoris with power may be simply a way of playing the game of patriarchal binary oppositional rules, simply reversing by substituting the clitoris for the penis without changing the terms of the methodology. I'd like to believe there might be another way to talk about power. In this form, women simply become better at being men than men. This merely argues for a power structure bound by the very values I believe Lindquist would wish to overthrow. One of my concerns is that this polarization of gender, class, age, and nationality deprives society and each of us of what it needs. I think Lindquist addresses this issue but doesn't develop. What happens to a culture where each individual becomes polarized within gender, within age, within class, and by education? The society is impoverished just as the individual is impoverished. There's no man who lives in Mali can make love to a woman and share her pleasure. That has been a possibility eliminated by the practice of the excision, which the endorses. Is there another parallel within our culture for the loss of pleasure, which one or all of us may experience in our relationships with others by the parts of them we have chosen to remove? Any problems I can identify with the essay clearly become quibbles and merely postpone the question of how do you respond to a paper like this? Well, I resisted reading it as long as I could. My husband read it. I said, "How is it?" He said, "Well, I don't know what you're going to say. It's great." And I thought, "I don't know what I'm going to say." I postponed it. I waited. Catherine called me and said, "What are you doing?" I said, "I haven't read the paper. Sorry. I'm sure it won't take me much time. Go ahead and read the paper." I found, though, after reading it, I have a lot to say. And what I want to say, I'm going to rush through very quickly so I can get as much of it said as possible. One, I want to make a point that I'm very disturbed by the fact that the same passion for truth and spiritual fire that keeps me a Mormon and makes me a feminist is forcing me to try and talk honestly today, which I don't want to do. I'd love to make a smooth rhetorical lateral arabesque and say, "Lovely, lovely Lacan. Thank you, Catherine. That was forceful." Let me just say, I think free agency is becoming more and more a complex issue. If we're compelled to use our free agency, are we really being free? Just think about that one for a little bit. I see that in some ways making choices becomes what we are about, that choosing, we are given gender, we are given biology, but certainly my hysterectomy let me know that you can take away your uterus without taking away your femininity, or can you? So the question about what biology gives us in terms of our gender, what our culture gives us, we are given a family. We don't choose them, but we do choose whom we love, whom mothers us, who fathers us, and who we will nurture. I've come to believe that we only possess what we choose, however consciously or unconsciously. So I'm brought to the point, however reluctantly, of saying, well, I think what Catherine's told us is true. Or at least, I rush to say, it's part of the truth. Without resorting to relativism, well, it's true for her, but I have my own truth, and you have yours, and a way to get around it, I'd like to talk about, if it is true, what can we do? And I'm inspired by her talk. One thing it's clear we can do is feel the pain. We can squirm. I thought it was very brave of you not to squirm. As I listened, I squirmed again. And it's my third time around. I want to talk about some very practical ways to do it. So I've borrowed, some of you may have seen a little book called 50 Easy Things to Save the Earth. Okay, I've got a list of 50 easy things you can do to identify and remove, excise, one might say, sexual hegemony from your life. First, accumulate scriptural evidence and consider the gender of the Holy Ghost. Two, identify your own learning skill or Myers-Briggs style, extroversion, introversion, intuitive, feeling, thinking, and then switch on the scale. There's a wonderful book called Please Understand Me if you can't get access to one of these learning models from a friendly social worker. Third, identify your least favorite singer. Then lip sync one of their songs four times, each time with greater feeling. Consider why the Romans, Greeks, Egyptians, Japanese, Hebrews, and Scots believe men could wear skirts and why we don't. Five, make a list of 10 androgynous names, Clancy, Francis, Terry, and then try and figure out why they're more androgynous than Ruth and Norman. Okay, pick up an infant, any infant, hold it. Then pretend it's of the opposite gender and see if you want to hold it differently. Seven, decide what real men eat if they don't eat quiche. Determine what real women eat. Identify what real kids eat. Then go have a donut. 8, switch jobs with someone in your family or workplace. Either hammer a nail, change a baby's diaper, take out the garbage, hum a lullaby, or do something else. You can do this once. You can do it for 5 minutes. You can try it for a day. If you want to be really revolutionary, try it for a week. In a Rorschach fashion, sit down and draft a list of gender-related categories like pink and blue, snip, snails, and puppy dog tails with sugar and spice, and everything's nice, and then figure out why they're truly oppositional. For example, why is it primary teachers are always female unless it's the blazer class? Read essays by Jacques Lacan and Julia Kristeva, then decide who is easier to read. Read the sports section or the living section of your daily newspaper. Whichever one you don't usually read it first this time. Sing church hymns with gender-neutral or gender-reversed language. Do scriptural research on women of the Old Testament, the New Testament, and the Book of Mormon, and then figure out what to do with the rest of the notebook you picked out for this purpose. Decide why women have been uniquely successful at writing murder mysteries. Take Hardy Red to lunch. Take Hardy Red's wife to lunch. Read Emily Fain's essay, Mother Killed the Rattlesnakes. Make a list of gendered competencies in your family of origin. For example, my dad does Dutch cooking and makes sourdough biscuits. My mother does crockpot cooking and makes sourdough bread. These are gendered competency in the Esplin family. Think about your own family. See if you can identify some. Learn the names of all the general presidencies of all church auxiliaries. Who in this room can name me one member of the Young Men's Presidency? Anyone here who can do that? I couldn't even remember for sure if there was one, but I'm sure there is. Decide if planets are male, female, or androgynous, considering the fact that only two in our solar system have female names. And can you name those two planets that are considered female in our solar system?
Venus.
Good. Second? Earth, yes. Discover when and why lace ceased becoming appropriate male attire. Okay, we don't have time for this. I have the other 30 items. Lynn, I have to stop, right? I have to stop. Okay. Five more minutes? Okay, all right. Okay, we're going to rush this. If most cooking is done by women, why are 85% of the great chefs of the world male? What is the connection between priesthood and motheringhood in your mind? Is it an equivalence, a hierarchy, or what? Who would you want to be with you if you were trapped on a desert island? Why? Read Virginia Woolf's large essay, small novel, A Room of One's Own. What role does gender play in your body, in your identity? Imagine losing part of your body. Which body parts would you lose, in what order, and why? If you share a bed with someone, switch sides for one night's sleep. And that means a dog and a cat. It works just as well. Read Susan Glasspool's A Jury for Peers and decide if you think there is or is not a male or female-oriented value system that should be brought into jurisprudence. Call a friend of the opposite gender and visit for 5 minutes. And take 1 minute and think how it feels. Think of one thing you never, ever want to do, ever. Identify its gender-related components. Repeat a nursery rhyme with a substitution of genders. For example, Martin had a little lamb, little girl blue, and Jane be nimble, Jane be quick, and old Father Hubbard. Wrap a birthday present for a man in flowery paper. Wrap a birthday present for a woman in stripes or a hunting motif. Decide why women can wear denim but men can't wear chiffon. Go into a men's shoe store. Go into a women's shoe store. Think about the difference. Describe a ritual for girls who have just had their 12th birthday, one you could perform as part of a sacrament meeting. Look up androgyny in the dictionary and list two androgynous traits you have or wish to develop. Stand in any selection of birthday cards. Tabulate the number for women, the number for men, and the number you could give to either. Read Meg Hoop's book on sibling order. It goes on. I have a lot of recommendations, and I think it's time we begin to say, if in fact we live in a world that we may not be totally comfortable with, if in fact there exist decisions made on the basis of gender that are part of our institutional church, that are part of our personal identity, what can we do to begin to make a difference? I've got 50 reasons, 55. You can think of some too, I'm sure. One of the things I know that we must do